We could turn our lights off. Yeah. On the...
Thank you. So
I want to thank Steve and the Perimeter Institute for having me here. I'm thrilled to be here, and I feel honored also to be giving this talk here. I'm a guy who started as a molecular spectroscopist, so I have all these questions about spectroscopy. That's why I'm a laser spectroscopist. I did my PhD in Paris North, you know, measuring molecular lines at really, really high resolution with super stable lasers. And then I went with Jan Hall at GILA as a postdoc in Boulder and learned to stabilize lasers even more, and eventually decided to go into quantum optics after doing quantum matter and classical fields. I decided to go all quantum if I could. This is some work that we've done with Steve and Nick Menicucci. So I have an experimental group at the University of Virginia that I started in 1999, and we have support from this excellent pointer here, from NSF and also DOD. And these are the main actors of this research. This is the theory column, and that's the experimental double column. And Nick, who I believe was a visitor here, actually got started that together, and Steve joined us soon thereafter. In 2006, Nick and I met at the Golden Conference of Quantum Information in Italy, and I asked something crazy question about continuous variable cluster states. And then Nick raised his hand after me and said, well, if you want to know more about that, the guy who asked the question, you should come see my poster. And so I did, and we started working on that. And Hussein is a graduate student who worked with us for some time. Jetai is my first postdoc who went, they got some entanglement results in our lab. And now went to the University of Maryland with Luis Orozco, work on cavity QED. Sheng Feng is my first PhD student. He's now with Prem Kumar at Northwestern. Raphael Puzer is my second PhD student. He's now a postdoc at NIST with Paul Lett. Both trying to do quantum information in different flavors, and Russell and Matt are current grad students. And so the idea of this talk, well, it's a pretty simple concept, and I really look at it like that. And you know, I know I'm talking to theorists, so I hope I bore you to tears, but you get it. And, but it doesn't look any more mysterious than it should be, because it's really not. And so basically, I'm talking about this quantum hop thing, and just to make a funny twist on it. But if you just take any kind of vibrating string or oscillator, in this case, an optical cavity, two mirrors facing each other, well, I claim that's a natural set of quantum strings, a natural set of quantum oscillators. And basically, the eigenmodes that are defined by the constructive interference of an optical wave, electromagnetic field going back and forth and interfering constructively after each round trip, give you a set of frequencies that are defined by the round trip constructive interference, separated by the free spectral range. And that's a bunch of modes. If you have a long cavity with highly reflective mirrors over a broad wavelength range, you have a lot of resonance frequencies. And each of these frequencies, okay, are a cavity mode. And classically speaking, it's a very, very, very clean system. It's an amazingly clean system. And of course, if you put a linear gain medium there, which is a medium that can emit light one photon at a time, it's a linear gain medium emits light one photon at a time, that makes a laser. And a laser is really, okay, classically speaking, is an amazingly clean system. You can mode lock it, phase stabilize it. You can have a linear gain medium whose bandwidth covers a great number of modes, up to a million, typically. And you have these femtosecond oscillators, or are called frequency combs, because the frequencies of the spectrum of these oscillators are extremely well defined and very stable. And they become frequency standards in their own right. And it's what led to the 2005 Nobel Prize to Jan Hall and Ted Hensch, the use of femtosecond stabilized optical frequency metrology, and revolutionizing thereof. And so my take on this is, why don't we look at all these modes and just decide, well, it's a set of quantum harmonic oscillators, each of them. Okay. And so can we consider that as potentially, I mean, scalability and decoherence, right? That's the big problem. And can we, could we look at this as sort of naturally scaled ensemble of quantum modes? And what do we have to do to implement the right interactions between them that would lead to entangled states and interesting things? I mean, is that a quantum register? And to do that, the first thing we have to do is start putting a nonlinear gain in there. And that turns it into not a laser, but an optical parametric oscillator, an OPO. And basically, by nonlinear, we mean a medium that emits photons at least two at a time, or three at a time, or four at a time. But two at a time is already hard enough. So that's where I'm going to stop. And this is going to start coupling modes together, and I will explain how in a second. And lead to multi-mode squeezing, multipartite entanglement. And essentially, it's going to create continuous variable states quite naturally that are eigenstates of a quadrature operators of a field that are analogous to position and momentum in a harmonic oscillator. So some technical aspects that make it easier and easier to consider and implement are nonlinear photonic crystals. And this is the point I'm really interested about, is the scalability potential. Can we really make large scale entanglement out of that, given that there's decoherence, given that, you know, we don't have, everybody has the same problems. And it's just yet another way to look at this and see whether we can get something out of this. And being an experimentalist, I really want the simplest possible system in the experimental field that I can work on, that I know about. Okay. And those things I know about, I know how to make them work. I know how to make them work single or two mode and make them make very difficult experiments work very well. And sort of my take on this is that if you have, instead of just two of these guys coupled together, if you have a great number of them, that doesn't increase the experimental complexity all that much, in fact. It's sort of what the main result that we've found. So this is largely a proposal, research that we propose to do, but this is nevertheless something based on research, on experimental results that we've obtained. So I'm going to explain quantum harmonic oscillators lend themselves really well to CV continuous variables. And what we've done in my group in the past years, we've used ultra-stable phase-locked OPOs above the threshold, it's like a laser, to demonstrate different effects, such as macroscopic Hongu-Mendel interference between Fock states, entanglement of two beams of light that are phase-locked. And we've started doing some theory before. We started working with Nick and Steve on the generation of continuous variable GAZ states in a single OPO. And so I've talked already about that. So this is what I'm talking about in terms of quantum states. So continuous variable states, continuous variable entanglement. Well, it's entanglement. That's the same definition, of course. It means that the state is not factorizable. And this is a completely unphysical, because not normalized, quantum state, which is in the eigenbasis of the position operator, which is this full-on destruction plus creation operator in a harmonic oscillator. That also coincides with the amplitude operator if A and A dagger are annihilation and creation operators for a quantum electromagnetic field. And the same way, we can have the phase operator analog to momentum. And of course, those two operators follow the canonical commutation relation between position and momentum, or amplitude and phase. So in a quantum wave, in a quantum when you do quantum optics, the measurement of the amplitude of the electromagnetic field and of its phase are not compatible. You can't know both perfectly. You have no one, the other one becomes noisy. It's like position and momentum. And so there's a Heisenberg uncertainty between them. And if you decide to decrease the uncertainty on the amplitude, then the uncertainty on the phase will increase. And sort of what's now known as squeezing. Now, if I go back to these states, if I have here an integral sum of all possible amplitudes, but with correlated amplitudes between two beams of light, two optical fields, that state Fourier transform is also exhibiting entanglement in with phase anticorrelations. Okay, and that's the EPR. That's the crux of the EPR paradox. This is an eigenstate of the amplitude difference. That is an eigenstate of the phase sum. Those two operators commute. X1 plus X2. Yes. No. Well, it's not any more than a perfect Bell state. In that sense, it doesn't differ from an ideal Bell state. If you make a perfect Bell state in a lab or
yeah. Yeah. I'm wondering if this would translate.
Yes. No. No. Everything has to be renormalized. Of course, in real life, this integral is truncated. But what really matters, it's a restriction. But what really matters is that, of course, if you measure one qubit, it's maximally mixed, so that the superposition coefficients here are all equal. That's exactly the same as a maximally entangled state for qubits. Yes. So there's some divergences here that we have to get rid of by truncating otherwise it's any test. But the bottom line is it's not any more entangled than the Bell state for qubits. It's a this is just unnormalized for the sake of sort of ease of writing, but this integral will go from x naught to x one.
I guess.
Or flat top, ideally a flat top window. Yes. And that's in any realistic experiment that's in my defense, in the EPR paper, they don't use those integrals. They use wave functions, but they are delta functions. So it's exactly the same. I mean, delta function is not any more physical than that thing here. So it's understood that you never have a delta function. You always have something with some width and a limited height. But there's no problem with considering truncated such integrals and working inside that little filtered space there. And if you really, another way of looking at that is to look at the Fock state basis, the photon number basis, where you see that this is an entangled state. It's sort of it's not continuous variables anymore. It's a qubit. Okay, so this is an infinite sum, same way these were infinite integrals. And that was due to Steve Van Enck, who has pointed that out in 99. This is really a Schmidt decomposition of that, because a Schmidt decomposition can always be taken discrete. Even for over continuous variables, you can always find a Schmidt decomposition as discrete. So that in that case, it's pretty straightforward. It's just the photon number operator eigenstate. So this is how the nice way of working with these guys is that we know what to measure. That was the thing. It was a paper by Lev Weidman in 94, shortly after the teleportation paper of Bennett et al. Came out. He looked at teleportation in a Heisenberg picture. What operators should we consider? And this is pretty clear that if you measure the amplitude difference here, you're always going to find zero in that state. This is an eigenstate of the amplitude difference, even though each of the amplitudes is extremely noisy, because there's all possible states there. Right? And here, if you look at the phase sum, it's going to be zero also. It's squeezed. Even though the phase noise is maximized, it's completely white phase noise. which is exactly the same way as a spin seamless state. If you want to know whether it's up or down on one subsystem, you this 50% chance of each, it's totally undetermined, but the correlations are 100% there. So this is sort of how it works, and we create approximations of these states by squeezing. And so squeezing is just this. This is, I'm going back to this cavity here. It has lots of modes. I'm just going to consider one of the frequencies of the cavity for now. Just not looking at the whole harp, the whole frequency, just one. There's one signal beam at one frequency resonating in that cavity, passing into that two photon emitting gain, actually annihilate a pump photon. The pump photon comes at a frequency that's twice the frequency of a signal beam. So that one pump photon has twice the energy of one photon of the signal. So for one annihilation of a pump photon, you emit two signal photons. And that's illustrated by this A dagger squared, which means two photons. And it's in the same field, so the two photons are emitted, they're completely indistinguishable, which means they have the same wave vector, direction of propagation, same polarization, direction of the electric field, and the same frequency. And they can also be absorbed two at a time because of hermeticity and linearity of the evolution. The quantum state result of this evolution is inside the cavity is that beast there. And you can show that, well, okay, so it's got that interaction constant that has the nonlinear coefficient of the material here and the pump field amplitude there. And the bigger those are, the more squeezing is there. And when you look at the variance of the operators for the amplitude and the phase in this case, you see that, well, they could be for a typical laser in a coherent state, they're both equal to one. But here, this one is bigger than one, and that one is smaller than one. So the phase noise here, the phase uncertainty, is reduced below one, which is the shot noise. And this one is increased because that's the Heisenberg uncertainty, where delta x times delta p equals one. It's a minimum uncertainty state. So if you reduce the noise in one observable, the canonically conjugate one will get noisier, of course. And the limit of that state here, when you take that squeezing parameter to infinity, you get actually a phase like this thing that I showed you before. And so this is old now. This was squeezing was sort of introduced theoretically in the early 80s and was done mid 80s experimentally and has been perfected. And it's now, the record is now 10 dB noise reduction. And with optics, and it's possible that the Yale group that work on superconducting implementation of quantum computing, Steve Gerwin, as I've heard him say, that they could shoot 30 dB of squeezing. So really getting, you know, if they could do that, really getting some really close approximations to these guys, it would be very interesting to see. And of course, maybe we can do that optically as well. 10 dB right now. Yeah. 10 dB in Schnabel's group in Germany. It's very recent. And I think there's good reason that we could, 10 dB, 20 dB is really hard, but 10 dB can be broken. It's been reached and it's all technical, of course. Our record in my lab is 7 dB. So we have significant amounts of noise reduction, so it's non-classical light, and we can do something with it. Now, another thing that we can do is entanglement. So how does that work? Well, entanglement in that picture is just something like squeezing. It's exactly like squeezing. In fact, it's exactly like what I showed you. It's the same thing. This is the Hamiltonian. We have a two-photon emitter. The only difference is that the two photons are emitted, they're distinguishable. Either they have different wave vectors, they diverge in propagation, or they have different polarizations. One is vertically polarized, the other one is horizontally polarized, or they have different frequencies. Whatever it is, they are characterized now by different field mode operators. And there's still a two-photon emission, one photon in one mode and one photon in the other. And for example, here in our experiment, they are cross-polarized, so we can separate them with polarizer. We get one photon here and one photon there. And of course, there are intensity correlations, photon number correlations that we can see. We call that twin beams. It's actually pretty fun to see them. Then you can do that with a single crystal, of course. You don't need the cavity. With the cavity, we bring the thing above threshold, and we see milliwatts of intensity correlated. The shot noise is identical. If you subtract the two shot noises, they go to zero. It's a lot of fun. At the same time, there's something else that's happening. It's not as clear from this Hamiltonian, but if you calculate the quorum evolution, you get that the phase sum is squeezed as well. So you get those eigenstates of sum over dx, xx, sum over dp, p minus p, which is the EPR. So it's an EPR state. It's an entangled state. It's a realization of the EPR paradox. That state here. And so all you need is what we call a non-degenerate OPO, because it emits in distinguishable modes for the photon pair. And this was seen by Kimball's group, then at Texas in 92. That was below threshold, so it was largely in the spontaneous emission regime. Very recently, three groups in the world, Brazil, US, my group, and China, have seen it above threshold with macroscopic beam emitting milliwatts power. Okay, that's just a different experimental twist. It's not really, in terms of fundamental physics, it's not very different. Now, what I'm going to, okay, this is entanglement between two things. Oh, okay, so that's not really, you know, in a fundamental sense, okay, that's not new. What's new is to try to entangle tens of systems, hundreds of systems, thousands of systems, see if we could build a quantum computer, see if quantum mechanics still holds in the mesoscopic regime for an entangled system, and all these things. Build a Schrödinger cat. This is what really motivates me more than anything, is to be able to see if I could ever be able to test quantum mechanics experimentally. Maybe I won't, but I have to try. So how do we scale to more than two beams? Okay, so there's two avenues, and I'm gonna get a little bit more technical now, but it's not gonna get any different from all these OPOs. It's just gonna be more of them on the slide, that's all. There's something that was realized a few years ago is if you take two degenerate OPOs, so two squeezers, we call that single mode squeezer. So one emits a phase eigenstate, phase squeeze beam, and the other one emits an amplitude eigenstate. And that's pretty easy to do. And you send them on the beam splitter, and you just overlap those two beams so that, you know, the transmitted beam here completely overlaps with the reflected beam there. And of course, the same is true on this side as well at the same time. Then you have an interference of both these guys, and the quantum interference, and you get actually an entangled state. From two, this is a product state of the squeeze, phase squeeze times amplitude squeeze. It's a product state, and the beam splitter is an entangler, which is funny because the beam splitter is a linear transformation. And, you know, people say, well, if you have an entangle, an entangling interaction, you can only have a nonlinear interaction. But in fact, the beam splitter is a linear operation, has a non-classical input. You really have to look at the input. So if you use linear optics with classical inputs, you do classical optics, you entangle nothing, there's no problem. So no surprise here. The beam splitter entangles only because there has been some real quantum optics done beforehand. Another way of looking at that is that you look at the Hamiltonian of both these OPOs. They are totally independent Hamiltonian. They're single mode squeezers. So you have a A dagger square guy there. And there's another one there. And there's a minus sign here that just tells you that this one is squeezing the phase and that one is going to squeeze the amplitude. And now what I can do is look at the Hamiltonian there. Well, it's pretty easy. I take the beam splitter transformation, which is a unitary rotation, and I apply it to that Hamiltonian. And what I get is the exact two mode squeezer non-degenerate Hamiltonian, which is another way of looking at this. And this has been, okay, this is nice because I will show you in a second that if you use N OPOs, N squeezers, and a big interferometer, then you can make, you can scale up to any kind of size if you have a lot of squeezing, of course, if it works really well, because everybody has the same problems. You can scale up the entangled state. I don't want to have N OPOs in my lab. I want to have one, and that's it. Because I have as many cavity modes in one OPO as I want. I don't see why I should have N single mode OPOs when each of them has a cavity with a very large number of modes, N minus one of which are unused, you know, and just one picked to make a non-classical state in it. So this is the whole approach. And I'm going to pause a little bit and give you more of the qubit to QNAT analogy to talk about cluster states, because that's really what we're after. And we found that there's actually some possibilities. This is the experiments that we're doing in my lab right now, trying to generate cluster states, continuous variable cluster states. So qubits, of course, computational basis. And this analogy has been worked out. It is completely straightforward. It has been worked out by Lloyd and Brownstein for quantum computing. And there's some kinks. You have to have negative Wigner functions and non-Gaussian operations there. But everything is pretty clear. There's no surprise. You can use, for example, the amplitude eigenstates as your computational basis. It's an infinite basis, dense basis, but it works. If you have a Bell state here, you can use an EPR state for your entangled resource, bipartite entanglement, and it works. Hadamard rotated basis is just a phase basis here, Fourier transform basis. To do that in the lab is very easy. It's just pi over phase shift. Just move a mirror by lambda over 4, and you have done your Fourier transform from X to P. The Pauli group is correspondence is the Weyl-Heisenberg group. And if I look at the cluster state, which is really what I'm interested in, so we have all these qubits, which are placed in a plus state and connected by control Z gates, which are gates that commute with one another, unitary gates. And that creates a cluster state, which you can use then to do one-way quantum computing, which was proposed by Rassendorf and Briegel in 2001. And recently, the exact analogy to this continuous variable was figured out by Jang and Brownstein, and also Menikuchi, Van Loek, Gu, Widbrook, Ralph, and Nielsen. As you have a plus Hadamard state here, you use a phase eigenstate, so phase quiz states. And then the analog to the control Z interaction is a control phase quantum non-demolition interaction, which is something that's sort of a variant of a squeezing interaction. It has been demonstrated. And so you can, in principle, create a continuous variable cluster state and do quantum computing with it. Okay. In principle, in practice, this is sheer madness, of course. This is not realistic at all. I'm going to tell you why. This is taken to the letter. This is what it amounts to. OK, I don't care. Let me just read this. One. This is just that state here. Okay, so the cluster state for 2 qubits is exactly the same as a Bell state. The 3 qubits is exactly the same as a GAZ state. It's only for 4 qubits and more, but it stands on its own. It's a different kind of state. It's neither GAZ nor W state, of course. So if I want to do this for continuous variable, that's taking it to the letter. I need to squeeze, phase squeeze one of these guys, phase squeeze the other guy, okay, here, that's 2 OPOs. And then I do my QND gate here, which does my control phase. And that can be done, it was shown in the 80s to work. You take a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, it has to be stabilized with 2 inline squeezers there, and that does the right thing. Okay, so that's, I am never going to do this in my lab. That's clear, it's too hard. If you want to do an EPR state, it's pretty easy. You can simplify, just take 2 OPOs, and there you go. You have an EPR state. It's the same as a cluster state, locally equivalent to a cluster state. And I've shown this before, and that one also with non-generate OPO works. Okay, so now I'm talking about scaling. I want not just this. I want a whole array, square, lattice, of cluster, the arbitrarily scalable cluster state. Well, this scales because I can make as many OPAs as I want and build as many Mach-Zehnder QND gates as I want. It's completely crazy, but it works. In principle, it works. So that scales. This one scales. There's a theorem that's called the Bloch-Messier decomposition that was found by Sam Brownstein that shows that you can always take n vacuum squeezers, put a big interferometer that has, maybe it's very complicated, lots of beam spinners there and phase shifts, and you can create any kind of continuous variable entangled state. Okay, but you still n OPOs and of the order of n square, of polynomial number of beam spinners, maybe n to the fourth, My proposal is a single PO, there's no interference. That's what we're after. And so why? Because in a single PO, there's a large number of cavity modes that I'm going to use. Whereas in this proposal, I'm only using one cavity mode out of a coom. Here, I'm using the whole coom. And the thing is that, well, there's going to be a little bit more complexity on the pump field, but it turns out not that much. And everything, all the magic is in the nonlinear medium. The nonlinear medium has to be implementing lots of different interactions. So this is how it works. Okay, that's the, for example, for the GSE state, what I was talking about. You take N OPOs, that's due to Van Loek and Brownstein, and it's been implemented for three beams by Furusawa in Japan and Qinshi Peng's group in China. And so you have NOPAs, NOPOs, and you put an interferometer, and then you come out and you have this entangled beam, entangled state, and that works. And for clusters, yes? No. Actually, there's.
So we know exactly the same way as we measure the fields. It's a good question. Let's see. This is what we measure. Okay. When you do coincidence total number detection, you measure that gap. And typically, all the experiments are done because there's no total number resulting detector yet. You cannot tell whether you have one or two, three or four. But you can tell whether you have one or zero. So they restrict the Hilbert space to one zero, and they do wonders using that. And it's in Fox
detection, so it's negative bigger function, so it's extremely powerful. It works well. It's not going to scale that well eventually, but for proof of principle, it's been an amazing tool. What we do here is we work with X and P. So classically speaking, it means we measure field. So to measure field, what you have to do in classical optics, you have to do interference measurements. And so all the measurements are done with an auxiliary laser field that interferes with the OPO beam, which is called local laser field, is called local oscillator. And it's in a coherent state that's well known. We know exactly how it behaves. And we generate the interference, we align it, and we look at the interference and more precisely the measurement noise. And we see that that noise is reduced, which is evidence of the squeezing one of the others. Yeah, homodyne header line.
So can I think of a level? So you can't squeeze instantly. So can I think about it, say, you said, yeah, they say it's
cluster. Yeah. Can I think of what the error is?
Well, so clearly, the answer to that, and I was asking Dan Gottesman about that because I'm still not sure exactly. But for sure, if I have the level of residual noise that I have on what I measured. Let's say I squeeze the phase. Okay, so I have a phase noise produced by a factor 10 below the shot noise. Okay, well, whatever error that's smaller than that level of residual noise, I am not going to be able to, and I'm not going to be able to correct. Right, and so eventually that's going to be the problem. The problem is if I lower the absolute level of the noise, though, I can bring it to a very low level. And then if the errors, you know, are too small, then I can go on and compute for a while. Of course, that's the idea. I don't know if there's been any quantitative description of, I guess it's maybe a bit too early to see, but teleportation experiments can work now. They work with 90% fidelity. I mean, Furusawa has done two teleportations in a row, or three teleportations in a row. He teleports and he teleports again, and see if it's still non-classical, and still, you know, there's a non-classical feature in the quantum state to begin with. And if your teleportation is not good enough, that thing is wiped out, and you just get a laser beam out that's completely classical coherent state. And they're able to get, you know, entanglement swapping has been done with continuous variables. With some reasonable degree. So some basic operations are done. There's been some experiments with teleportation with tripartite entanglement, with teleportation network with three partners, quantum secret sharing between three. So there's been some basic protocols. I'm not talking about quantum computing over even 10 qubits. So, but that's the idea. That's the answer. Okay, so going back to this idea. So this is what, okay, so this is, you have NOPOs, I don't want NOPOs, I don't want an interferometer, I just want one. And so I'm asking the question in very general terms, is that possible? I just have one guy, I don't know what's inside. I'm gonna have to work on this. I'm coming out with a coom, a quantum hop, and I wanna know whether all these guys, 1, 2, 3, n, are just the frequencies, one free spectral range away, can be put in that entangled state. In the same way we can see squeezing, we can see nonlinear optics, we can see that stuff. It's there. We can tell whether it's there or not. If it's not there, we'll see also. And turns out for a GZ state, it's pretty easy to answer that. And then it was kind of, I barely dared asking myself that question. It was in 2003 because I thought, this is a stupid question. Probably everybody who knows anything in quantum optics has sort of dismissed it in advance because it's too trivial. Turns out it was actually new. And so I look at this. Let's take just five. It could be whatever number. And let's assume I don't know exactly how I'm going to do this practically. Now I know. At the time I don't know. But let's assume I can put a two mode squeezing interaction there. So I put this blue line here means I put a photon pair in this and that beam, and at the same time in this and that and this and that, all possible pairs. Okay. And so I can actually write the Hamiltonian for this. It's just the Hamiltonian that I wrote, but now there's a sum of lots of possible pairs, all the possible pairs. And I can solve the Heisenberg equation for this, for the field. It's pretty easy. And I have a system that's like that. This is the Heisenberg equation, assuming a classical pump, which is actually physically justifiable and reasonable. You can get in a regime where it works like that in a spontaneous function region. And I have this coupling matrix here, which is actually very important. And I can solve for the eigenmodes and the quantum evolution. And what I find is that I have squeezing. I have squeezed the negative exponentials here. And the operators that are squeezed are all the amplitude differences and the sum of all the phases. And just trust me on this, these are the entanglement witnesses for that state. These are the operators whose this state is an eigenstate of. So that actually shows that this guy actually generates a GAZ state. So if I can do it in a single view, I get a GAZ state out. And I can draw a graph, and that's not the graph state in the now usual sense of graph states and cluster states. It's a different definition. It's a graph of a Hamiltonian. Each node represents the cavity mode, initially in a vacuum state, not in a particular phase state or anything. And each edge represents a coupling in a Hamiltonian pair. So I can sort of draw my Hamiltonian, and okay, that makes a GAZ state. The NOPO thing that I showed you with a big interferometer has that kind of Hamiltonian here. This is all the NOPOs here, all the Hamiltonians. Actually, they're all amplitude squeezing and one is phase squeezing. And then that's the beam splitter interferometer unitary transformation. And I did that calculation and you get that Hamiltonian out, which is exactly the same Hamiltonian as this guy. So you get the same graph. Plus a bunch of degenerate interactions, and they're in different color because if all the blue lines correspond to photon pair emission, then the red lines correspond to photon pair annihilation, which is impossible to do in the same OPO. The same OPO, it will all emit or all absorb, but it's not going to do a little bit of both. Right? But that's okay because that proposal is for n different OPOs in an interferometer, so it's a difference. But the bottom line is that you see how these two are related. They have the same kind of graph. Topologically, it's a complete graph. It's self-loops on top. But it's not a very significant difference. And it turns out we're using the block Messier reduction for continuous variables of Sam Brownstein's. You can show that it's a one-way sort of projection transformation. My model maps onto theirs. And so they got the idea first, but there's no way to get mine from there because it's a projection that goes down that way. So the Brock MSCI is a nice confirmation, but I couldn't get it's an in, this is an independent idea from back. Okay, so now I'm going to cluster states. I'm still not talking about how I'll talk about the experimental implementations in a few words a little bit later. But now, say this is all GAZ state, but it would be nice to do cluster states. And this is where Nick and Steve came in, and really were power hitters on that subject. And the bottom line is, okay, if I go back to this guy here, this Hamiltonian here is a sum of all possible pairs. That's this complete graph here. And that coupling matrix, when I solve the Heisenberg equations, is really exactly, very exactly, the adjacency matrix of a graph. So that matrix has zeros where there's no correction, no edge, and one when there's an edge. So between row one, column two, there's an edge. Let's say this is one, this is two, there's an edge. But between one and one, there's no edge, there's no self loop there. And so you can describe the graph by adjacency matrix. And that adjacency matrix is right there in the Hamiltonian, in fact. It's all taken care of by the notation on the summation index in that case. And so I can make it appear explicitly, which is what this GKL thing is here. It's the adjacency matrix of the graph. I call that the H graph, the Hamiltonian graph. Okay. And now I can also look at the cluster state graph definition for continuous variables. And again, there's a big skip there. It can be written as this set of equations, which is the phase for mode k divided minus sum of this over this matrix element times the positions for summated over modes equals zero or squeezed. That's and that guy here is exactly the cluster graph adjacency matrix. That's by definition. So okay, the bottom line is, which is what Nick and Steve posed the problem. They said, well, we posed the problem together. I said, can we say if I have this, this is what I can do in my lab. I understand this. This is what we need to do quantum computing, to do a cluster state. I don't understand this, but I understand what it is in theory. Right. Is there a possibility to build something here that would yield that? Does there exist a correspondence, an analytic correspondence? And the answer that Nick and Steve came up with said, yes, there's an existence proof, a theorem, that says, yes, if you have such a system with an H graph, you can show that it does correspond to a cluster graph of some sort. Now, is that cluster graph something completely crazy, or is it a square lattice? That's another question. But the analytical correspondence is there. Well, OK, so I'm not going to go into this detail, but there's a lot of matrix algebra involved, with some additional degrees of freedom that we usually take. Additional, these are all matrix blocks, by the way. And the important point to take home is that it's an existence proof. Yes, it works. It's not a very tight constraint. There's lots of possibilities. Now, here are a few examples. This is the GAZ state again, this time for four modes. So that's the guy I showed you before with a five mode. This is a complete graph for four modes. And okay. There is a correspondence. This is an H graph. The corresponding cluster graph is that guy. It's a star graph, which is known for qubits, actually, that the GAZ state is both a complete graph or a star graph under LC equivalence, under local complementation, which is something that was pointed out for graph states by Brigale and his collaborators a couple years ago. So for continuous variables, the same is true. We did find that, yes, but this is a different type of graph as this one. So the local complementation thing must be taken with a grain of salt in this case of continuous variables. But if I make a GAZ state, it'll make a star graph. Okay, star graphs are not very interesting for if I have an n-mode GAZ state, I'm going to get a star graph with n minus one branches, so it's not a square lattice. So this is, but that for illustration, this is how it works. And now let's look at the cluster state. There is actually a particular example which we're now working in my lab to create. And remember, it's a single OPO thing. we can find an H graph. So there's four cavity modes, and we can implement four different interactions, not six, no diagonals there. It's not the complete graph, it's just a square lattice, simplest version of it. And actually, the standard cluster graph is actually identical to it, which is an interesting property. And it is also a cluster state. So for four modes, we can do that. And don't have too much time. I will it requires that the nonlinear optics in the OPO medium have the ability to phase match three different nonlinear interactions at the same time. And that just for nonlinear optics was new enough that we could publish it, Rafael Kuzer, my student, because we engineered a nonlinear interaction to do second harmonic generation, which is what photon pair absorption, emission absorption system, with type one caveat. Depends which wavelength you start with. Using different polarizations for the optical fields, we showed that this is the wavelength. At the same wavelength, we have all three interactions turned on at the same time together. And we can use, these are the cavity modes for different polarizations, with the crystal being birefringent, non-isotropic. The cavity modes have different frequencies. This is a lot of technical details. But the bottom line is, what you want to be careful is to do a closed set of interactions. You don't want, you just want to entangle the modes in the coom, in the quantum hop, that you want in the set. You don't want any spurious additional coupling to other modes. Just going to sort of leak all the entanglement out and not absolutely not create what you want. And it's pretty easy to see from solving the Heisenberg equations for these systems. But in this case, it's possible to get a closed system. And that's a single OPO. It's got two pump fields instead of one, with polarizations that are defined, actually plus and minus 45 degrees. And we get some horizontal and vertical signal fields, two at the same frequency, but they cross polarize, and two at different frequencies here. And they should be in a cluster state. Now, OK, that's just four. I want 10,000. I want a gazillion. And so in principle, and you know, it's sort of, I have to admire Nick and Steve, because they put up with all the experimental constraints that I throw at them. I say, I don't understand the topology of this thing. I just want to make sure that it's going to work in the lab. And so they're very patient with me. I say, well, OK, so what does that mean? And actually, all these things scale up. So if you look at this representation, and that's sort of the end of this, this is still my cavity modes there. You know, this is the frequency axis here, and I have a resonance frequency in the cavity, plus one crystal range, plus two crystal range, plus three crystal ranges. And here, this is a pump field. And that pump field, this is actually half its frequency. So that the frequency of the pump field, which is twice that out there, is the sum of this plus that, and also the sum of one plus four. So I take half the frequency, it's exactly the average point. So that pump mode is going to couple this pair, that pair. There's another pair there, and a couple too, and a pair like that. So that's a single OPO. That's a simple OPO with a single pump field. It's old. It's very old. The OPO has been around since the 60s. Quantum optics with OPO has been around since the 80s. But that thing makes lots of entangled pairs. Not just one, lots of them. OK, fine. That's not very interesting, just entangled pairs. Now, if you just look at this and you add another pump field right there, now you couple those two different pairs that were independent before. So that's the H graph, and that's the standard cluster graph, which is just cluster state. Now, those two guys are coupled there. So that's my Hamiltonian now. And turns out, when you look at the cluster state graph, it is actually already a square cluster. So when you look at these things, it's actually very simple to get cluster state entanglement. A little caveat there that this guy is going to entangle mode 2 and mode 5 that I haven't drawn here, and it's going to mess everything up. So I have to make sure that that coupling between 2 and 5 is killed. But you can engineer the nonlinear crystal to do that too. It's possible to, it's called engineering the phase matching bandwidth. So it's a little bit more complicated than the thing I showed you just before. Because it doesn't use polarization, so you cannot sort the degrees of freedom as efficiently, but it's still doable. Now, okay, I got a 2x2 cluster. Actually, I can get a lot of them. If I just take I back up a little bit. I take a bigger view, right? I have all my bunch of pairs there in green. And this pump used to be there. And now I pushed it a little bit away, just a little bit away. And now I let it couple three different groups. And that, OK, I won't go through this in detail, but you just believe it actually makes a cluster. One goes all the way to 12, goes back to 7, and 7 goes to 6, and that's it. And 6 is coupled to nobody else. So that's this guy. And you have closed sets like that. One closed set, one closed set. These are all cluster states. So the Coombe starts to be entangled as a quorum register with cluster states. OK, they're tiny cluster states. They're not very useful. But you see that you can, the same way I scaled up my pairs, I can scale up my four-mode cluster states. So the question is, can we make a bigger cluster states? And the answer is yes. So last summer, we found that, OK, you just add a few more pump fields that way. These actually, the difference in color, these create photon pair emission. These create photon pair absorption. That's pretty easy. You just have to phase shift the pumps respect to one another. And so that's easily controllable in the experiment. So you could say, oh, but you're transferring phase control, optical phase control to the pump field instead of having them on the signal field where you used to have an interferometer that you got rid of. And I will answer, yes, but I don't have an interferometer. The number of pump modes here is going to be much less than that. Turns out it's just a few, which is an amazing thing that we discovered. It's really not a lot. If I do this completely messy thing here, there's a logic to the madness here. It's not completely apparent on that diagram. That makes sort of a cubic eight-node graph, cubic graph. You can see it's sort of a same as a cube, so flattened cube. If I measure two of these guys, this is, by the way, it's the cluster graph. It's not the well, it's actually identical to the edge graph in that case. If I measure two of these guys, because it's a cluster state, the rest is going to stay entangled. The measured qubit, I don't know. I'm going to sever all the entangling connection between the measured qubits and the rest. And I'm getting a 2x3 cluster. The same way I took some, now I'm going to take some perspective and back up a little bit, back away from this. I still have six pumps. I have a lot more, twice as many modes. And it turns out I'm creating with these guys, and I haven't drawn the couplings because it goes really complicated. I get two now, 2x3 clusters. And so the same way I can scale up the number of 2x3 clusters, the pairs of 2x2 clusters, I can do with 2x3 clusters. So we thought, well, we're on the right track. And then we got stuck. Until October, I think, in November, when I got an email from Nick and Steve, say, okay, we got it. We got the square lattice. This is what it looks like. We're working on this. This is a exclusive presentation of it's a first. It's a world's first. Well, okay. So the idea is, okay, 15 pump fields only. Whatever number you have here. So the number of pump fields does not scale with n, not even polynomially. It stays sort of a small number. I'm happy to work with 15 pump fields and engineer some crazy laser beam thing to make it work in my lab. Now, this is the idea. The square lattice, in fact, this is the idea they had. You want something that's like that. And the problem is, well, those guys are pretty easy to figure out. They have four edges each, right? These guys here have three. And of course, the four corners have two. And when we think about how to, you know, we have to sort of map this out of a Coombe of modes, a quantum hop. And their idea is, well, if you make coupling so that this wraps over itself, makes a tube, cyclic boundary conditions. Then you take the tube and you wrap it around, you make a torus. Then all points, it's a well-known thing in physics, and it's nothing, but it's really clever to have thought about it. Then all neighborhoods are the same order, four edges for anybody. And we get a torus, of course. But now if you take a line and you measure along it, you cut up the torus, you unfold it, and you have a grid. And so the topology of this, and the beauty of this is it's a single OPO thing. It does not take resources scaling even polynomially, only 15 pound fields, and I think we can, I suspect we can bring that down a little bit. And so there is a way to make, and that's a whole cost. It's legitimately defined continuous variable cluster state in terms of the Weyl-Heisenberg group, completely analogous to the Pauli group that defines the qubit cluster state. And so, okay, we're not going to make that thing as I don't know how many gazillions nodes there. It's just a pretty picture. But the idea is to do, right now we're trying to do in my lab the multiple square thing where we have two squares and then show that we have two squares and they're entangled in the square cluster state and they're not entangled between each other. So I'll show this, and so this is what we're working on a single appeal. And that leads me to my conclusion. Basically, the bottom line, and I haven't put any technical transparencies there, but all the bipartite stuff I have there, and you know, if you really, really insist, I'm happy to show it to you. But the experiment is not any harder than bipartite entanglement experiments, which are really hard. I mean, getting those fields to be stable, to measure them, all these interference measurements have to be stabilized and controlled well and everything. Once you can do that, well, might as well just scale. And but the big deal in this research was to figure out whether scaling, I mean, it was a difficult theoretical question. There was no way. This is an example of beautiful collaboration. And so I'm going to show the faces of the heroes here again. And thank you for your attention.
In your examples and your calculations, you have this mapping standard between all those mode pairs. That seems naive. That seems like a difficult.
That's a good question. It is. So obviously, the first thing we do is take the simplest case.
It's a very good question. It's not obvious to assume that in a real experiment. However, those coupling constants, they depend on several things. And so I can grab one somewhere. So this is really the whole coupling constant here. And so the chi is the nonlinearity of the material. And it has bandwidth to it. And actually, there's two things. And the beta is the pump amplitude. So I have many pumps. I can change their amplitudes. So I have a knob there, which is a very good one. It's not necessarily going to solve all my problems, but the chi can be engineered in photon. And I only mentioned it. We use photonic crystals, where in particular we use quasi-phase match crystals, where the nonlinear interaction is made efficient and built up by building a spatial modulation of a nonlinear coefficient. We use ferroelectric materials, they are cold, and every sort of 10 microns, 40 microns, depending on that period, the domain is flipped. And the nonlinear coefficient changes time. And when you look at the nonlinear interaction with this such spatial modulation, it selects out the nonlinear modulation you want and not the others. The others are not phase matched. So they are very inefficient. So we can select. Now you can actually fully engineer that. You could say, well, I have equal duty cycle square wave, but now I can make unequal duty cycles. And it's sort of a Fourier engineering with some constraints because the polling is only a square wave, right? So you don't have infinite degrees of freedom like you would do in Fourier synthesis. But nevertheless, it's powerful enough that you can actually do pretty much. You can phase match two or three, and that's the thing that I showed you there, like there. That page turning effect is pretty, but slow. This is where an example where I engineered three of them. And I can then, here we didn't care. We just made them roughly the same strength, but we can engineer the heights of these coupling constants. So in fact, we can control everything. by engineering the nonlinear interaction and pump amplitudes, we can pretty much reach the level where everybody is going to be reasonably the same. I have to thank you for listening to two talks in a row. These were very good talks. So that's a very good question. If, as I scale up the thing, if you go with single photons, if I understand it correctly, you need really to have an n photon emitter to scale up, really, which is hard. I mean, you have, you know, two photon down conversion. And in this scheme, you don't add any pump modes, but you have to crank up the power, yes. But it's not going to have to be ridiculous, I think. Well, at least, let's say, my guess, my bet is, before it gets ridiculous, we can get in an interesting regime. That's my bet. Maybe before we can get to a real quantum computer, it'll be ridiculous. But before we can study the coherence of the mesoscopic entangled state, maybe we can. That's what I'm coming. I don't know.
But instead with photons, we have less and less. How does loss affect the performance of the system?
Yep, same as everybody, it kills everything. It's a good question. The squeezing decreases. So essentially, in these experiments, everything is seen in terms of comparison to the vacuum fluctuations. So if you have the, you remember the delta X, delta P, which is what we measure really in the experiment. For a laser beam, which is a coherent state, which we call a classical state, delta X equals delta P equals 1. And if you have a squeeze state sort of represented by an ellipse in phase space, so it's the area is conserved. If you have losses, that guy starts going back towards the circle, and so that's the main it's the coherence. It's the main issue. We can have detectors that are 99% quantum efficiency and better. They're not single photon sensitive. So that's the price of it. There's no detector right now that's 100% quantum efficiency, one electron. See every photon without missing, and single photon sensitivity. But that may happen maybe sooner than we think. But we're close to 100% quantum efficiency, but we don't have single photon sensitivity, but that's fine because we're not working with photon number measurements. Basically, you have to reduce all the losses inside your cavity, which is where the, because you do many, many round trips. So a tiny loss in the crystal, it's going to be multipassed, and that's our limit, right? But I think that still that still allows us to reach to probably reach and exceed 10 dB of squeezing. I mean, there's a group in Germany that has the nonlinear crystals are at that level where that you can get an order of magnitude noise reduction, which is, you know, so for a quantum computer, I don't know if it's enough, probably. I had to bet, I'm pretty sure it's not. But for proof of principle experiments, it's a lot. So, but any type of photon loss is cannot be redeemed. Unlike when you use, for instance, actually, if you lose one photon in one, you just wait for both to arrive and you get a coincidence. That's fine. But we don't have anything equivalent in those field measurements. So everything has to be perfect.
Thank you.